This is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca. Families of the victims mourn as Indian authorities investigate the cause of a devastating fire that killed at least 43 people in a factory in central New Delhi early Sunday, as relatives of the workers who were trapped inside waited outside a hospital mortuary to identify the dead. Firefighters had to fight the blaze from 100 meters away because it broke out in one of the area's many alleyways. Many of the victims were asleep in the factory when the blaze began. The FBI has officially identified the shooter at the U.S. Naval Air Base in Pensacola, Florida, who shot and killed three people on Friday. The shooter was Mohammed Al-Shamrani, a 21-year-old second lieutenant in the Royal Saudi Air Force, who was a student naval flight officer at the Naval Aviation Schools Command at Naval Air Station Pensacola. The FBI has not determined a motive for Al-Shamrani's rampage and whether it was terror-related. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper.
I can't say it's terrorism at this time. I think we need to let the investigators, the FBI, do its work.
The victims were also students at the flight school. The shooter, who was also killed in the incident, is reported to have hosted a dinner party earlier in the week where he showed videos of mass U.S. shootings to his guests, according to media reports. At least one of his guests is reported to have videotaped Friday's massacre. Several Saudi students are being held for questioning. Before the pilot opened fire at the base, he tweeted a will and quoted Osama bin Laden in justifying his actions. U.S. Democratic lawmakers met privately Saturday to work on the investigation into President Donald Trump. Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee are working through the weekend to review evidence and draft impeachment charges that they can recommend for a full House vote as early as Thursday. This is VOA News. North Korea says it has carried out a very important test at its long-range rocket launch site. The announcement comes amid dimming prospects for a resumption of nuclear negotiations between North Korea and the United States. Iran and the U.S. conducted a prisoner exchange involving a Princeton graduate student detained by Iran and an Iranian scientist held by the U.S. AP's Charles de Ledesma has the story.
In a trade conducted in Zurich, Switzerland, Iranian officials handed over Chinese-American graduates student Shiyu Wang, detained in Tehran since 2016 for scientist Masoud Soleimani, who had faced federal trial in Georgia. While the exchange represents a rare win for both countries, it comes as Iran still faces crushing American sanctions and the aftermath of national protests. President Donald Trump has acknowledged Wang was freed in a statement from the White House, saying the Princeton scholar would be returning to the United States. I'm Charles Ledesma.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a draft budget of about $39 billion to Parliament today. He says it's designed to resist U.S. sanctions by limiting dependence on oil exports. Thousands of people formed a human chain in central Brussels on Sunday to draw attention to the need for urgent joint action against climate change. Some 2,400 people took part in the peaceful demonstration, police said, which encircled the Belgian Federal Parliament and the Royal Palace. Climate Action Network spokesperson Zanna van Rentergem.
So today we are making a human chain around a couple of the Belgian parliaments. We have four, so that's a lot. We are making a chain with about 3,000 people, and there's a big trajectory with 12 checkpoints. All of those present the checks and balances of a good climate policy, meaning it has to be ambitious but also fair, and it has to be, you know, we need to be able to pay for it, but it also has to be expensive for the big polluters.
The two-hour demonstration took place as policymakers from around the world gathered in Madrid for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. British voters are gearing up for a snap general election on December the 12th. All 650 seats in the House of Commons are up for grabs next week when voters will pass judgment on an ill-tempered and divisive election. There's one section of the population who could swing the result one way or the other, Muslims. Securing votes from this community could be decisive, especially in certain marginal seats. Zainab Ghulamali is the head of public affairs for the Muslim Council of Britain.
We reached out to our affiliates, of which we have over 500 at the start of this election, and started to discuss ways in which we could engage Muslim communities in this election and crucially encourage them to register to vote. We decided it would be great to have a national day of action where mosques and community centres and ordinary Muslims nationwide took part.
Muslim Council of Britain has identified 31 marginal seats where the Muslim vote could sway the outcome. Joe Palca, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
The population is tired. They want to return to normal life. One of the things we told our population was that there are so many recommendations we made during the major national dialogue, and some of those resolutions are already set for implementation.
A call for help in reconstruction in Cameroon after the effects of the separatist war.
In many parts of Africa, media freedom is a matter of life or death. We've got a lot of journalists who are in jail now simply because somebody somewhere in a position of power did not like the headline, did not like the soundbite, did not like the work that the journalists did.
A look at the state of freedom of expression and safety of journalists in Africa.
For us, we look at the severity of the situation and coupled with the fact that the forecast for this 2019-2020 agricultural season is also not good. It is almost similar to last year's forecast. We reckon that we would be in for a long run.
And the struggle to raise more money to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Deadly flooding in Uganda has claimed at least 20 lives as the region reels from weeks of rain. The Red Cross says rescuers have been recovering the bodies of victims swept to their deaths by the flash floods in the western Bundibugyo area. The aid group says homes have been washed away and a number of roads blocked or destroyed. Local media report that search and rescue teams recovered 10 more bodies Sunday. Heavy rain have been battering the country for weeks and intensified overnight on Friday into Saturday. Large parts of East Africa have suffered floods and landslides in recent weeks. Hundreds have died and millions have been displaced. The events have been linked to an unusual weather phenomenon in the Indian Ocean. Diplomats, UN agency heads and non-government organizations converged this week to discuss rebuilding towns and villages scarred by the separatist war in Cameroon. Cameroon's government says it needs help reconstructing destroyed schools and public buildings. Those in attendance said they are willing to help but want to make sure the war is over first. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Prime Minister Joseph John Gute, who convened the meeting on behalf of the government, pleaded with the international community to help reconstruct Cameroon after close to 4 years of bloody conflicts that have killed thousands and caused severe damage in dozens of towns and villages. Gute says most citizens are opting for peace because they are tired of all the killings.
The label of Cameroon being a peace-loving and stable country has been destroyed. And Cameroonians of all walks of life, from all the four corners of the country, think that it is time for us to regain that status which we once held as a peaceful country, a country to which other people came for refuge, a country that received people rather than sent out people.
Representatives from about 24 of the 75 diplomatic missions, United Nations agencies, and international NGOs in Cameroon attended the meeting. John Gute did not say if all of them were invited, but said some had told him they had other tight schedules. Philippe Larieux, chargé d'affaires of the French embassy in Yaoundé, says France was ready to contribute to the reconstruction plans.
We have 62 million euros that can be devoted to the reconstruction of the northwest and south region, and it's up to the government of Cameroon to ask this amount for the reconstruction of these two regions.
Jean-Luc Stallone, representative of the United Nations Development Programme says his institution will assist in the reconstruction plan once they are certain that peace has returned. But it is not clear when the fighting will end, as fighting between separatists and government troops are reported almost on a daily basis, though with less intensity than in the past. The meeting took place shortly after delegates dispatched by the government on so-called peace caravans trip returned from trips to discuss the outcome of the recent national dialogue hosted by the government in Yaoundé. Catholic Bishop Andrew Nkea led one caravan to the English-speaking southwest region. He says many people want a return to peace.
The population is tired. They want to return to normal life. One of the things we told our population was that there are so many recommendations we made during the major national dialogue, and some of those resolutions are already set for implementation. But without a peaceful atmosphere, it will be difficult to get to those recommendations.
Officials did not disclose how much money Cameroon needs for the reconstruction, but in 2018, the Central African State launched a $23 million emergency humanitarian assistance plan for hundreds of thousands of its citizens who the government said were living in precarious conditions in Cameroon and Nigeria due to the separatist conflict. The separatists launched their war in 2016, citing alleged domination by the country's French-speaking majority. Since 2016, the war has killed close to 3,000 people and displaced 500,000. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Impunity for those who murder and commit other crimes against journalists creates a vicious circle that allows such crimes to continue. These sentiments emerged at a meeting held in Maseru, Lesotho, last week to discuss the state of freedom of expression and safety of journalists in Africa. Reporter Kuzanai Musengi attended the meeting and filed the following report.
The meeting, dubbed the Freedom of Expression Festival, agreed that the continued violations against journalists and failure to bring perpetrators to book pose a serious threat to the safety of journalists and to freedom of expression at large. UNESCO Regional Advisor on the Safety of Journalists, Lydia Gachungi, one of the speakers at the meeting, revealed that 51 journalists have been murdered in the past 5 years across Africa. She said impunity makes it possible for such violations to continue.
It's only one case that you may find out of every 10 that is investigated, and this is a very worrying trend because it means that a lot of the perpetrators go scot-free, and what is happening that it becomes a vicious cycle. The more attacks you have and perpetrators go scot-free, the more they continue doing these things because nothing is being done.
A participant at the meeting, Abigail Gamanya of Zimbabwe, based Gender and Media Connect, said the focus on the safety of journalists should also include tackling problems that female journalists face, including sexual harassment in the workplace.
There are issues such as sexual assault or sexual harassment that happens to women at the workplace and outside the workplace. And this harassment or assault is usually perpetrated by colleagues or peers within the media who are usually in a position of power. And we find that as media support groups or as an industry, we usually neglect this area.
Gachungi agreed that female journalists face more peculiar problems regarding their safety. She said UNESCO has observed that violations against female journalists are on the increase in Africa.
The worst bit is the fact that even our own media houses have not put in place some mechanism to protect the female journalists. They assume that male and female journalists face the same kind of intimidation or harassment or attacks, but this is very different on the ground.
According to UNESCO, 24 African countries now have clear laws relating to access to information. But Gachungi said this does not necessarily mean that access to information is easy, nor does it mean that freedom of information is enhanced, as proper implementation of such laws is often lacking. Chairperson Jovial Randall of the African Editors Forum, or TAEF, said his organization had decided to convene the meeting because of increasing concerns over the state of freedom of expression and safety of journalists in most African countries.
In many parts of Africa, media freedom is a matter of life or death. We've got a lot of journalists who are in jail now simply because somebody somewhere in a position of power did not like the headline, did not like the soundbite, did not like the work that the journalist did.
Randall said his organization had decided to hold the inaugural Freedom of Expression Festival in Lesotho as the country is in the process of reviewing its laws, including those relating to media, with the aim of making them more liberal. The African Editors Forum is a grouping of representative organizations for media practitioners in Africa and has over 400 members. Reporting for VOA from Maseru, Lesotho, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
Berlin, Paris, and London are common destinations for African artists seeking to establish their careers and build name recognition. But as they focus their attention on the West, they risk being forgotten at home. Such was the inspiration behind a traveling exhibition making its way across Africa. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Hundreds of people from around the world are gathered in Dakar's Museum of Black Civilizations for the grand opening of a contemporary art exhibition called Prête-moi ton rêve, or Lend Me Your Dream. Guests draped in elaborate African robes admire an array of intricate sculptures, striking photographs, and textured paintings. There are more than 100 works by 30 artists from 15 African countries, including Ivory Coast, Congo, Morocco, and Mali. For many of the artists, the opportunity to show their work to other Africans is a rare occasion. Fir Ketane is the Secretary General of the Foundation for the Development of Contemporary African Culture, which organized the exhibit. He said the goal of the exhibition is to assemble the best in contemporary African art and display the work for an African audience.
Sur leur terre d'origine. Et donc nous avons eu l'idée avec les artistes.
He says they realized these artists had been successful in Paris, Italy, London, and New York, yet they had not achieved the same recognition in their home countries. So they came up with the idea to bring them together on African soil. The idea is to reconcile the market value of Africa so that Africans can, in a way, share in their success. The exhibit will travel to 7 African cities over the course of 1 year, including Casablanca, Abidjan, Lagos, Addis Ababa, Cape Town, and Marrakesh. In doing so, the exhibit seeks to unite the continent's web of cultures and ethnic traditions while celebrating African art in its place of origin. Yakuba Konate is one of the exhibit's curators. He said he hopes the show will help internationally renowned African artists forge a relationship with their neighbors at home.
L'Afrique a été souvent oubliée par les gens qui organisaient des expositions.
He says Africa was often forgotten by exhibition organizers. Their exhibits toured Paris, Dusseldorf, and London, but no one thought about the necessity or interest there would be to show African works in Africa. Even when organizers do consider touring Africa, Konate said they give up easily and claim it's impossible due to inadequate facilities and insufficient funding.
Donc c'est tous ces problèmes-là que nous voulons prendre ensemble.
He says they wanted to take on these problems and constraints together, and then see, little by little, that they can remove these obstacles and show that it's possible. One of the featured artists is Ivorian sculptor Siri Kiki. He said it was important for him and the other artists to have their work considered by fellow Africans.
On travaille beaucoup plus pour l'Occident, on est dans le en dehors de l'Afrique.
He says they work much more in the West, outside of Africa. That's why they wanted to participate in this exhibit, so that their neighbors and parents can see their work, interpret it, and decide whether or not they like it. But at least they'll know that they're doing this work. The exhibition will remain on display at Dakar's Musée des Civilisations Noires through January 28th. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
The United Nations World Food Programme says it's struggling to raise more than $200 million to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Economic collapse and recurring drought in the country, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, have left 5.5 million people without enough food to eat. Columbus Mavinga reports from Harare.
Maria Gunzi is using a hoe tilling her land as Zimbabwe's rainy season begins. But the 66-year-old widow is worried that she will not have enough food to last until the next harvest. Hunger and poverty are real here. I do not have fertilizer for the land I'm preparing, she says. All my crops were burned by the sun last season, and there's no food aid coming. These wild fruits are not getting buyers. People are broke, she adds. I wish the government would chip in with assistance, especially for us, the old. Hunger is giving me a real headache, says Gunzi. Gunzi is among the 5.5 million people in Zimbabwe who the World Food Programme says are food insecure until at least next April because of the collapsed economy and recurring droughts. Eddie Rowe, the director of World Food Programme in Zimbabwe.
For us, we look at the severity of the situation and coupled with the fact that the forecast for this 2019-2020 agricultural season is also not good. It is almost similar to last year's forecast. We reckon that we would be in for a long run.
WFP says Zambia, from where the UN agents sometimes imports food to aid Zimbabwe, is also affected by drought and has imposed a ban on corn exports. Also, the agent says it needs to raise more money to help Zimbabwe.
We are running against time because we need to have these commodities in country by January for us to implement this program at scale, reaching 4.1 million people from January up to April, and then 1.5 May and June. It would cost us a total of $293 million. We've only received 30% of that, meaning that we have a funding gap of $211 million.
The WFP official maintains hope that international donors will assist Zimbabwe, though he knows the country is competing for funds with emergency situations in war-torn places like Yemen, Sudan and Somalia. Any aid would be a relief to Maria Gunzi, who says climate change has affected him, as she used to be able to fend for herself. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
And now I'm joined by Shirley Tabila. She's also known as Cookie Team. She's visiting us here from Accra, Ghana. Welcome to VOA.
Thank you, Douglas.
You're very much welcome.
Thank you.
You are an actress. You are into the media. You are an events host. What brings you to Washington, D.C.?
It's been a long year of, let me say, too much hard work, if I can put it that way. I do radio 5 times a day. Monday through Fridays, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. every day. My show is called The Star Drive. It's on Star 103.5 FM. On Wednesdays, I have a relationship program that I host on TV as well. But when I'm not on radio and I'm not on TV, I am definitely hosting events. So corporate events to private events and all that. So I decided that, listen, it's Thanksgiving. You've been working too hard. Just come and cool off with the family. I mean, it's Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, just come celebrate with the family. I haven't seen them in a bit, and then just go back to work.
I see.
Because this December is really busy in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you've been traveling the U.S. On vacation. Mm. What do you find? What's interesting do you find here? What in comparison, what's back home in Ghana?
First of all, let me talk about VOA.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into radio. I mean, you mentioned it, yes. And this edifice is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've seen anything like it back home. No, we don't have it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a lot of radio stations, almost over 400. Over 400 radio stations. But they're all individual houses. So you enter there, the buildings are not this huge. But this edifice is fantastic. But then I see some gadgets, very similar ones that we have back at home. I see the consoles and everything. So pretty much the same thing.
I see.
Yeah.
Briefly about the media, you're in the media also. How do you compare the media there and here? And how free are the Ghanaian media?
Ghanaian media is very, very free. Mm-hmm. I mean, some time back, it was getting a little out of hand where people can actually call, especially for call-in shows, where listeners call in and then they start to attack political leaders and all that. I mean, they even go as far as attacking their person.
Mm-hmm.
But that is changing because that's not the way it's supposed to be. Media, we are supposed to put positivity out there. It's not a place where people can just come and just start saying negative things. So now, for us presenters back home, once you start to go that way, no, we'll cut you off. We'll tell you that, listen, this is radio. This is not what we are supposed to do. We are supposed to construct. We are supposed to criticize constructively and not negatively, not destructively.
I see.
Yeah.
Now that I have you here, as you know that this is the year of return.
Yes.
Tell me about it and tell me how prepared Ghana is for that.
All right. So 400 years ago, the first set of slaves landed here in the U.S. in Jamestown. So this year, we are calling it Year of Return. Because we want all of you to come back, all of you here in America and all over the world. Last year, we had a good number of you coming home. Boris Kujo, Michael Jai White. I cannot even remember everybody, but we had too many friends and family from the diaspora visiting Ghana. This year, I don't even know if we can contain the numbers because from the statistics that I have, almost 750,000 visas have been issued out to Ghana. Air tickets are overbooked. Airplanes are overbooked. You cannot even get a flight to Ghana right now. You cannot. Mm. Hotels are booked. Apartments are booked. And people are even converting their homes into Airbnb.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how critical the situation is. But we are ready. In terms of entertainment, you're going to have a good time. We have a whole long list of lineups of events from Sarkodie's Rapaholic concert to Afrochella. Mm-hmm. As I speak, Cardi B is in Ghana performing in a few hours. She was in Nigeria last night. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Red Cross is coming to Ghana. Meek Mill is coming to Ghana. It's just going to be too much fun. So we want you to come back home to feel the culture, to feel exactly what we have back at home and not only what you see on TV and here on the radio.
I see. We'll be coming to Ghana indeed. But now that you're here, what strikes you about your visit? What did you find so different from back home?
Okay, so I wanted to tell you the story earlier, even before we came live. I went to the mall on Black Friday. And when I got into Macy's, it was Macy's at the Palisades Mall. And the DJ was playing, he was playing good songs. He was playing African songs. He was playing a song by Wizkid from Nigeria. I was like, oh, that's cool. I mean, I hear an African representation. But I just wondered if he had anything from Ghana that he could play. So I walked up to him. He introduced himself. He said his name is DJ Impact. So hi, DJ Impact, wherever you are. And then I was like, okay, I have a couple of names from Ghana. Shatawale Kidi, Kwame Eugene, Stoneboy. Who do you have? Do you have anything from Ghana? He says no. So we went onto the internet and then he got a song. I gave him Kwesi Afe's Anthem. That's the title of the song. He found it and then he started to play it and the whole mall just went into a frenzy. Everybody was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
People were shazamming the songs and asking me where I'm from and who the artist is and everything. So it was a very proud Ghanaian moment for me. I was like, oh, if all of us would come out here and at least in our own small ways, make our culture known, make our artists and everybody else known, it will go a long way.
I see. Good enough at VOA, we play music from Ghana and from across the African continent.
Right. Thank you. I would love to hear something before I leave, though.
Thank you very much.
savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is the Voice of America in Washington, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the second part of the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah and our Sunday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And now on to our Nightline Africa sports. Morocco's Raja Casablanca secured a vital 1-0 win away to AS Vita Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo on Friday at the second round of group games in this season's Africa Champions League got underway. A 48th-minute goal from Sofiane Rahimi was enough to give Raja the victory in Group B, which is made up of four former winners. The results earned the Moroccans their first win of the group phase, with the Vita Club bottom of the standings after two consecutive defeats. The reigning African champions, Esperance of Tunisia, are top of Group D after they beat Algeria's JS Kabylie 1-0 at home on Friday night. Elsewhere on Friday, Egypt giants Al Ahly got their Champions League bid back on track with a 2-1 victory over Al Hilal of Sudan in Group B. Ahly, record 8 times winners of the trophy, needed a win after defeat to Etoile du Sahel in the first round of group matches. On Saturday, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia and TP Mazembe of the DR Congo both won away from home. Etoile were 3-0 winners away to Platinum of Zimbabwe to go top of Group B with 2 wins from 2. A brace for Karim Aribi set the Tunisians up for the victory with goals in the 23rd minute and then straight after the break. Etoile added a third through Hazem Haj Hassan just before the final whistle to seal the victory. The result leaves Platinum bottom of the standings with no points. Also on Saturday, TP Mazembe beat Zesco United 2-1 in Zambia to maintain their perfect start to their Group A campaign. Zamalek of Egypt beat Angola's Primeiro de Agosto 2-0 in the late Group A match on Saturday night. In Group C, another Angolan club, Petro Atlético, got their first point of the group campaign with a 1-1 draw at home to Algeria's USM Alger. In the same group, Mamelodi Sundowns maintained top spot in Group C after securing a point at CAF Champions League rivals Wydad Casablanca on Saturday night. The game ended in a goalless draw. The group winners and runners-up will qualify for the quarterfinals. And in boxing, Anthony Joshua outpointed Andy Ruiz Jr. to reclaim unified heavyweight titles in Saudi Arabia on Saturday night. 6 months after stunning knockout loss, Anthony Joshua used his size and feet to regain control of the heavyweight division and put both his career and status as a global boxing superstar back on track. Joshua, who came in 11 pounds lighter than his upset loss in June, outboxed Andy Ruiz Jr. in Saturday's rematch and avoided trouble to regain his WBA, WBO, and IBF titles via wide unanimous decision. Joshua, the 2012 Olympic gold medalist from Great Britain, won on all scorecards of all three judges in Daria, Saudi Arabia. Still in boxing, undefeated WBC middleweight champion Jamal Charlo walked through the resistance of Dennis Hogan and stopped him in round 7 on Saturday night at Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. After going the distance in his previous 2 bouts, Charlo vowed to finish Hogan early, and he did. Charlo dropped Hogan with an uppercut early in round 4, But Hogan gamely survived Charlo's furious follow-up. Charlo continued to stalk Hogan, and in round seven, he floored Hogan again with a lead left hook to end it. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Don't no, no, no. Anywhere you day, I go for no, no, no. I go love you today and tomorrow, go, go. Baby, come to
Gambo, Musaja, Quata, with a Sawu, you are Kuwa, Musala.
make a fight for the love. In a curse, make a curse for the love. It's not fight, I go fight for the love. Superwoman is a superman. Your love give me time where I know you to understand. Fine girl, you don't need no other man, no other man. Your love give me time where I know you to explain. Girl, I wanna give you good love.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Netline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There has been a worrying pattern since the Supreme Court in Kenya turned down the election of the president and called for new elections. Since then, many African countries and politicians raised the hopes that their own courts may also overturn elections which they disapprove of. In a sense, we should not bemoan the fact that opposition parties or parties are resorting to the court when they are dissatisfied. Because even though the Supreme Court recalled the election in Kenya, did not change the results in the sense that the incumbent was returned to his seat. It is better for political parties to resort to the court than to take up arms to fight. In fact, all electoral laws in the continent, as elsewhere, have always placed a remedy to those who need it, that if they do not agree with the results of an election, they could go to the court to seek remedies. So we should all applaud that fact, that there is a tendency to seek remedy in the courts. Whether or not we should hope that governments have special courts for elections that would expedite the process is another matter. But we should not discourage political parties and others to seek remedy in courts. Nevertheless, there are also other troubling factors that we should take into account. Quite often, appeals are made to the court even when the winning candidate has been inaugurated and is serving as president. That can cause some problems. The Kenyan model is better. The Kenyan model, you cannot be sworn in until the court has rendered its verdict. If you take the case of Malawi, which is the most difficult now on the continent, the elections in Malawi was held long time ago, yet the court has not yet rendered its decision on the appeal of the opposition. In the meantime, the incumbent has been inaugurated. He has been traveling the globe as the new president of Malawi. And there is a worry, what would happen if the court now switched? So So this has to be revisited as to whether the model of Kenya is much more suitable. But also in Malawi, we had a situation where the opposition, while in court against the president, are also demonstrating on a daily basis against the head of the Electoral Commission, calling for her withdrawal or removal. And this has caused a lot of disturbances, domestic disturbances in the country. And if you look at Nigeria, a similar thing has happened. The president has been inaugurated much fanfare before the court made a ruling. And that has caused some problems with the opposition when the results of the court finally was announced. But one which was not expected was the case of Botswana. Botswana has always been a peaceful, democratic state. And the last election showed it was still a peaceful, democratic state. But the opposition did not agree to the result of the election on the grounds that the incumbent president, contrary to historical events, was able to win almost all the constituency in the capital and its environment. In the past, the opposition have captured those seats. But there are explanations for that. But now, because of that, the opposition is appealing to the court, not because of any specific malpractice, but because it does not fit the historical development. Some have argued that the reason why the incumbent president won the seats in the capital and his environment was because of the former president linking himself with the opposition. But this is beside the point. But we don't know yet how that will play out in Botswana. So what we have to expect now is that don't discourage those who go to the courts. We require it. But appeal to governments to have special electoral courts for the electoral period so that they could render decisions quickly. And we also should appeal to those who may want to resort to the courts to be very careful and not make it so carelessly that people may not pay attention. This is why it is a good requirement that all governments now pay attention to this pattern of practice, that opposition parties or those losing election will almost definitely resort to the court for final decisions. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From all of us here at Nightline Africa, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Producer Saida Hamdon, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.